This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, electricity is the country's most polluting industry, and this $300 billion industry is about to be radically restructured. Some say the environment will be the big loser. Ever wondered why police don't pull over polluting cars or trucks? One listener did and asked us to investigate. Across the country, people have been heading out to find out where the eagles soar. It's the annual Midwinter Eagle Survey. And in the Earth calendar, we hoot all night long with a saw-whet owl. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. Electricity is the most polluting industry in the U.S. and possibly the world. Now, a movement is underway across the country to restructure the electric industry to allow customers to choose who generates their power. The hope is that prices will drop and new technologies will be introduced. But many worry that restructuring will mean cheaper energy at the expense of the environment. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports.
Today, if you want electricity, you can buy from the utility company or sit in the dark. But over the next several years, that will change. The electric industry will be opened up to competition, and you'll be allowed to select from any power company the same way you now choose long distance.
We're essentially talking about turning the electric utility industry upside down.
Ted Freeman is the managing editor of Electric Power Alert, an industry magazine. He says how the electric industry is restructured will profoundly affect the environment because cheap and often dirty power may have an edge in the competitive market. The first people regulators will allow to access this inexpensive power will be large industrial corporations, but environmentalists say they will fight to prevent pollution.
Industrial customers who are very anxious to bring about a competitive environment are doing everything they can to separate the issue of the environment from the issue of electric restructuring. And they're arguing that these two issues of the environment and energy are not linked. Environmentalists, on the other hand, are saying that they are inextricably linked.
Much of the dispute over air pollution comes from older power plants. They're allowed to emit more pollution under current clean air laws. Environmentalists blame them for a significant portion of the pollution caused by electric generation. Some of the highest concentrations of these plants are in the Midwest. Their emissions drift hundreds of miles and pollute the air in the Northeast. The worry is that this situation will get even worse with competition. Janine Shaheen is the governor of New Hampshire. She says Northeast states pay for bad air when they violate federal clean air laws and when their citizens get sick.
But we bear the brunt of the dirty practices of those utilities in the Midwest. And the fact is we're paying more for our electricity because of it. We're paying more for our cleanup, and it's very important that we do something about it. And I think this is an area where we've got to see federal involvement, that it's not fair for those of us in New England to have to pay those costs.
Shaheen and other lawmakers in the Northeast may curtail or even outright block some power from the Midwest in order to prevent an increase in air pollution. The big fight now is whether Congress will force older power plants to meet the same emission standards as newer plants. That would make a state like New York very happy. It barred construction of coal-fired power plants decades ago to improve air quality. But it adds roughly 10% to New Yorkers' electric rates. Businesses in the Northeast and New York say they deserve access to cheap Midwestern power to lower their rates. Barbara Brenner is with the law firm of Couch White, Brenner & Feigenbaum, which represents industrial companies. She says it's unfair to prevent them from getting a good deal.
I do not think that the Northeast should do anything that will disadvantage itself economically vis-a-vis the rest of the country. And if we don't buy it in the Northeast, we still have the environmental fallout from it. So then we have the worst of all possible worlds. We can't buy the cheaper power, and we still have the environmental impact.
Another major concern for environmentalists is investment in energy efficiency and renewable energy. Both have largely been funded by utilities through ratepayer bills. But in the future, that funding may dry up. Environmentalists say the technology for renewables and energy efficiency is here, but implementing it on a large scale may take 20 years. They worry there won't be enough interest in the private sector to make it to the day when these investments pay off. This will likely be addressed in federal legislation, which may mandate spending for these projects. Representative Dan Schaefer is the chair of the House Energy and Power Subcommittee and a congressman from Colorado. He's introduced a restructuring bill and says renewables and energy efficiency are taken care of.
You know, we have a section in our bill that deals with renewable energies, that a certain percent of the portfolio of the utilities have to renewables or green. And if people want to use them, they certainly should have the ability to do it, even though they may cost a little more, but that should be a choice of the individual.
But Schaefer's optimism is not shared by all. Environmentalists and consumer advocates say the restructuring process in Washington and in state capitals is being dominated by utilities and large corporations, which are reluctant to spend money on environmental issues. Lobbyists have descended on lawmakers' offices and are largely getting what they want, which is sometimes in contrast to what environmentalists want. Edward Rothschild is with Citizen Action. He says current federal restructuring legislation does not assure that the environment or small consumers will be protected.
We think that the restructuring is going in the wrong direction. Wall Street analysts are saying that we could end up with 10 huge companies in this kind of market. Well, why exchange a regulated monopoly for a deregulated monopoly?
Rothschild is equally displeased with the action on the Senate side. There, Frank Murkowski, Republican senator from Alaska and head of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, has convened a series of workshops to study restructuring. Environmentalists largely mistrust Murkowski and claim he's too close with industry. But Murkowski says that's where expertise is found, and he wants to place more control in the hands of the states, which can make decisions based on their circumstances.
But I'm not suggesting we got the answers. But we're going to get the answers from the people who know what and have to live in the environment of providing energy. And that's hard to oftentimes communicate to the public, because the public expects the government to have the answers. The industry is going to come up with the answers, as far as I'm concerned.
That's exactly what raises the ire of environmentalists. They say the electric industry should be just one of many voices in the restructuring debate. On the state level, consumer advocates and environmentalists have mixed reviews. But the process is still in its early phases. William Spratley is the editor of the LEAP letter, which tracks restructuring.
Right now, this is very much, as Justice Louis Brandeis said, a laboratory of democracy, each state going its own way. And the time will come when this will have to be made more coherent.
You'll be hearing more about this issue. Electricity affects virtually all aspects of the economy and environment. So as deadlines approach and decisions are made, each group will have something to say. For now, environmentalists say they view electric utility restructuring as an opportunity to improve a heavily polluting industry. But expect that to change if assurances are not made that air quality will improve and clean energy is encouraged. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
The Environment Show wants to hear from you. Our new email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Tell us what's on your mind or send us questions you have about the environment. Or visit us on the internet where you can hear the Environment Show anytime. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. Our toll-free number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Environment Show producer Stephanie Goichman finds the answer to a question we got by email from a listener in New York.
Listener Sheila Pratt asks, why don't state troopers give out tickets to polluting trucks? Where I live, there are so many trucks going through. What is the state police going to do to keep their emissions clean? Rich Castle, senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, responds.
The state troopers don't have, as part of their responsibility, regulating the emissions of truck or for that matter, car engines. That responsibility really is held in two places. The federal government, which sets tailpipe standards for trucks, and state governments that can put into place the kind of inspection and maintenance programs for trucks that we all have with our cars. So the real answer to the question is, how do we get states to take their environmental responsibilities with respect to trucks more seriously? And I think the answer comes from people raising this issue with their legislators and writing to their state environmental departments and saying, we think trucks should be handled the same way as cars. We think that trucks should be asked to undergo emissions inspections and maintenance. That's the way that we can capture those trucks that are the most dirty and require their cleanup.
Although enforcement of polluting trucks is inconsistent from state to state, when we contacted the New York State Police, they directed us to the Department of Environmental Conservation, which directed us back to the New York State Police. Unfortunately, we did not receive a response from either party in time for this broadcast. In contrast, state police in California will pull over polluting trucks and ticket them. Jack Schwendener, an automotive engineer with the California Highway Patrol, says his state has been building on their standards for quite some time.
We have a number of ways that we enforce laws against polluting trucks and other vehicles. For some time, we've had a couple of vehicle code sections that we've used. One of them applies to all vehicles, cars as well as trucks and buses, and it prohibits a discharge of excessive smoke, flame, gas, or oil or fuel residue from vehicles. Usually that's applied to smoke, and it can maybe sometimes be a little subjective, but it is used and has been used for vehicles of all types that are smoking too much. We also have another section that's intended pretty much just for diesel-type vehicles, and it again prohibits the discharge of smoke. But in this case, it uses what we call a Ringelmann chart, which is a little card with a hole in the middle and various shades of gray for comparison. And the officers can kind of hold that up to their eye and take a look and see how dark the smoke is. And if it exceeds a certain darkness, then they can pull that truck over and write a ticket for that. We have another method that's just now coming online, and it's based on the SAE, Society of Automotive Engineers, snap idle test, which kind of simulates a diesel engine under load, and it uses an electronic opacity meter rather than just the officer's eye for comparison purposes, so it's a lot more objective. And that's probably going to be, I think, pretty effective out here. They've had a little trouble getting it developed and getting it to work and be consistent and make sure that it picks the dirty trucks out from the clean trucks, but they seem to be getting that pretty well worked out, so we expect to see more of that, and I would expect that probably a number of states will go with that if it starts to work.
So do you find that this is really being enforced by the Highway Patrol?
It is being enforced, but I can't tell you that it's a real priority. You know, we consider drunk drivers, unsafe lane changes, running stoplights, and excessive speed to be a lot more of a concern from a safety standpoint, and we are mostly concerned with safety. So I can't say that it's our number one priority, but we certainly do write tickets for excessive smoke. And at least I get complaints from truckers who call up and complain because they had been cited, and I have to try and explain what our procedures are. So we do write some.
If you have a question about the environment, call us at 1-888-49-GREEN. You just might tune in to find an answer to your question next week on The Environment Show.
That was producer Stephanie Goishman with this week's listener questions. Next, we soar with the eagles.
It's estimated that before Europeans came to this country, 500,000 bald eagles soared the skies. Several factors led to the reduction of their numbers, but most notable was the use of the insecticide DDT. By 1972, the year DDT was finally banned, less than 420 bald eagles remained in the lower 48 states. Listed as an endangered species in 1978, important steps have been taken to protect, reintroduce, and monitor our national symbol. Environment Show producer Linda Anderson gives us an eagle-eye view on the National Midwinter Bald Eagle Survey.
On a brisk January morning, Ron Rinone drives up a country road along the Baton Kill River in upstate New York. Rinone, a middle school biology and earth science teacher, is peering intently into the tops of trees, looking for that telltale sign of a bald eagle, a white head.
I've seen him sitting right here, right this close to the water. And you can tell it's been a mild winter, just there's hardly any ice here at all. Typically, in a winter, at least most of this channel would be frozen because it's not very deep here. It's about less than 3 feet deep here. So this channel's almost completely open. So eagles have a wide range. And the bigger area they have to feed, the harder it is to find them, because that means their movements are not restricted to just open water. They can really move around to sections of open water that are not so easily visible from any nearby road. They're a little skittish around people, so they don't like to habitate really close to a lot of people activity. And staying in a car is a prerequisite for most eagle watching. So I'm just going to slow down here and take a closer look.
In January, Rinone joined professional conservationists, biologists, and hundreds of private individuals like himself in the National Midwinter Bald Eagle Survey. As Rinone drives along the Baton Kill, he explains that the bald eagles he's looking for come down from Canada, where lakes and rivers are frozen over. In New York, as elsewhere along the Canadian border, eagles move south, searching for open water. When they find it, they'll typically perch nearby, where they can feed on fish, duck, geese, or whatever else might be available. During hard winters, eagles may travel south as early as December, but generally, mid-January to mid-February is prime time for bald eagles, says Peter Nye. He's head of the Endangered Species Program in New York and coordinator for that state's Bald Eagle Survey.
In mid-January, when the survey is run, that is the time when all the eagles theoretically will have come out of Canada, will be where they are going to be wintering, and they can be counted kind of in a static condition. In other words, they won't be moving around very much. Winter visitors will be here, and they can be counted before they start to leave again in the spring.
Nye says New York has been monitoring eagles since 1979, and populations of wintering bald eagles have been increasing steadily, as is true for the rest of the country. He says the midwinter survey tells wildlife officials how the bald eagle population is doing, and is kept separate from a nesting survey, which establishes the numbers of nesting or breeding pairs in the country. Nye explains that since the late 70s, New York State reintroduced 198 bald eagles from Alaska, resulting today in 29 nesting pairs. The populations do mix, he says, but generally, breeding populations are kept separate and remain smaller, since it takes 5 years for bald eagles to mature. Great patience is required for eagle watching, and sightings are not guaranteed. Having no luck on the Baton Kill, Rinone moves on to his next site.
Now we're driving along the shore of the Hoosick River in Scaghtycoke, New York. And it's a very large sycamore trees and maple trees, and looking for some of the favorite eagle roosts, and sometimes they'll be here. The one part about this section is that numerous immature eagles will hang out here, and they're harder to see because they don't have the characteristic white
head. Bald eagles are immature for the first 3 years of their lives. When they leave the nest or fledge, they are full grown with a 6-foot wingspan, weighing 8 to 14 pounds, and standing 2.5 feet tall. Peter Nye says many people do not recognize these immatures as bald eagles, because they're mostly brown with white mottling.
By the fourth year, they begin to show much more of a dark body and a white head and tail that's characteristic of an adult sexually mature bald eagle. and they're not completely white. There's some dark flecking still in the tail and in the head. And then by 5 years old, when they're fully sexual mature, then you have a pretty much full white head and tail and brown body, big yellow bill, big yellow eyes, big yellow feet, which is hard to miss.
Bald eagles live for an average of 20 to 30 years, and according to Karen Steenhoff, who coordinates the National Bald Eagle Survey for the Biological Resources Division of the United States Geological Survey, the greatest threat they face today is loss of habitat. Their numbers have risen since the banning of the insecticide DDT, and 2 years ago they were removed from the endangered species list. But Steenhoff is worried because some states, like Washington, haven't been participating in the survey lately.
I think it is important that monitoring continue, so that we are certain that the populations are continuing to do well. I mentioned that some states have kind of taken the attitude that, well, the eagle's on the right track, so we don't have to monitor them anymore. And personally, I think that's a mistake, because I think we have to make sure that things are continuing on the track they're continuing.
It's too soon for this year's bald eagle count, but last year, 15,722 bald eagles were counted in the lower 48 states. 174 of those were in New York. This year's mild winter is expected to bring the numbers down, but on the whole, sightings of bald eagles are on the rise, and that's good news for the eagles and those who enjoy watching them. For the Environment Show, I'm Linda Anderson.
Slowly, a couple miles an hour, and stop.
Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. All across the northern part of the United States, tiny saw-whet owls are now hooting all night to find a mate. In northern Michigan, it's prime time to hear the saw-whet's monotonous call. Rich Bateson is a wildlife biologist and photographer in Michigan, and he spends his nights this time of year recording the saw-whet to find out how many owls have returned and how large their territories are.
Well, the saw-whet owls have returned to northern Michigan, and we begin the surveys of the seven-year study that we've initiated in northern Michigan on seven study sites, and we've located 28 territorial calling saw-whet owls. The males call on territory to attract the females, and they have returned within the last 10 days to 14 days.
Although there is still 3 feet of snow on the ground, Bates says he knows spring has arrived when he begins hearing the saw-whets. He says the owls have many calls, but almost always use the call you're hearing now. He told Environment Show producer Thomas Lally that the owls have to call to find a mate because they live in the dark.
And their behavior is such that they would not be able to be seen, being a nocturnal species. And so what they do is they call. And this call is a monotone type of sound that's repeated, say, 3 times every 2 seconds. It starts right after dusk, and it repeats right through daylight in the morning, and then they're very repetitive and then continue to do that until they might pair bond or mate, and then like many of the other owls, they become somewhat silent, and like most of the year, you don't hear too many of the owl species.
So they don't call for most of the year, is that right?
No, the saw-whet owl and other species of northern forest owls, such as the hawk owl and specifically the boreal owl, are actually quite silent during most of the seasons, except during the breeding season, where they do this auditory, broadcast to attract a mate.
Though tiny, these creatures are skilled hunters. They're equipped with sharp claws and beaks and eat almost exclusively small mammals like mice and voles. Bateson says they can hear and see so well, they can even locate prey under the snow.
The owls have both keen hearing and vision. My understanding is that they've done studies and established that owls could take a mouse just by hearing alone. They've also had a situation where they had a mouse that they put out in one of those football type stadiums and had one candle in it, and the owl was able to go down. And the owls have the facial disc that you see on the owls that are somewhat the round circular thing in their face actually is utilized to channel the sounds is that they gather to the ears on the sides of these facial discs, and that's why they're so effective at hearing.
If the saw-whet owl were in high school, he'd be the smallest in the class. He'd probably be showed up by his bigger competitors and fail to get a date for the prom. But if you wanted to go with him and he wasn't hooting, it means he's already taken. In fact, he doesn't give a hoot. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we look at the snowball inside the Hale-Bopp comet. Astronomers think it will help us find out where our oceans came from. Investment advisors talk green and answer questions about green investing. Do environmentally conscious mutual funds make any sense? Singer-songwriter Alice DiMicelli defends the Earth. Her tools are her voice and her guitar. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. During March, the biggest thing in the pre-dawn sky has been the Hale-Bopp comet. I've been watching it through the window while lying in bed. Astronomers say it may help us determine where the Earth's oceans come from. What we see as we look skyward is gas and dust being released by the comet when it is struck by the rays of our sun. We don't see the center of the comet itself, which Dr. Michael Mumma, chief scientist for planetary research at the Goddard Space Flight Center, says is made of ice. It's 25 miles in diameter, but this is not ordinary ice.
Well, let me say one thing about the concept of a block of ice. I think that's a very misleading concept. People would think of literally a block of ice that you might buy at your local ice plant or an ice cube you'd freeze in your refrigerator. A better idea is to keep in mind a very fluffy structure, more like a bunch of loosely coagulated snowflakes, not even one that you packed in with your hands, but one that has fallen in the fluffiest manner imaginable and gives rise to a very tenuous structure.
The icy nucleus of the comet becomes embedded with small grains of dust the size of smoke particles. As these come off in the sunlight, they form the comet's tail. Dr. Mumma says the materials the comet accumulated as it was formed are what may tell us more about the formation of our solar system, the oceans, and possibly the origins of life on Earth.
Well, there are three things of interest regarding these comets, particularly the ones like Hale-Bopp that are visit the sun relatively infrequently. These are bodies that are the most pristine material remaining from the time of planet formation in the early solar system. By actually measuring the composition of the comet, we can compare that with the composition of interstellar ices, which preceded our solar system. And then, in this way, we can determine to what kinds of processes actually occurred in the early solar system. It might have changed those ices and affected the manner in which planets formed and the manner in which the pre-biological organic chemicals were delivered to the early Earth.
I asked Dr. Mumma whether comet ices striking the Earth were responsible for water formation here.
As a matter of fact, that's the current view. And, of course, like all scientific theories, it requires detailed measurement for verification and change. Currently, we think that the early Earth, when it first accreted, was exceedingly hot. The rocks were molten at the surface. There were no oceans. The atmosphere boiled off into space. And had things gone on from there without comets, we wouldn't have the beautiful world we have today. We believe that in the first few hundred million years after the Earth formed, it was visited by a host of comet nuclei that impacted the Earth, and each one brought in its inventory of water and other organic chemicals.
Mooma says that in the last 10 years, we've learned that the chemistry of all comets is not the same, but differs as the comets were formed at different times. There are other theories about the formation of the oceans. One is that our atmosphere and oceans formed when volcanoes here on Earth spewed out a lot of chemicals and gas, which resulted in water and a primitive atmosphere. That theory holds that lightning strikes on the chemical stew led to the formation of building blocks of biological life. But at the moment, Mooma says he believes comet impact caused ocean formation. On the basis of your own research, I take it you are an advocate of the comet impact model?
At the present time, I am, actually. I find the comet hydrogen abundance ratio, the deuterium to hydrogen ratio I mentioned earlier, to be fully consistent with the view that the Earth's hydrogen was delivered by impact from comets. But I don't feel fully bound by that theory. In fact, my view is that we need to make measurements in many, many comets in order to validate that, because measuring one comet is not sufficient. These bodies were formed at different distances from the protosun. They show evidence that their chemical composition is quite different from body to body. For example, the methyl alcohol abundance changes by an order of magnitude, factor of 10 relative to water. And so we think it's very important to establish what the average value of deuterium to hydrogen in comets is. And you can't do that by measuring just one. You need to measure a significant number of them.
Whether you are a scientist exploring the origins of our oceans and terrestrial life, or a layman who is inspired by gazing at the night sky, Hale Bopp is quite a show. Paul Feldman, professor of physics and astronomy at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, describes its size.
The Central Bureau for Astronomical Telegrams in Cambridge, Massachusetts, keeps records of comets and their observations dating back to some 2,000 years or more. And according to Brian Marsden, he believes that this is perhaps the largest comet in the past 200 years. I think it was the Great Comet of 1811. That he compares this to.
And for those of you who have missed Hale Bopp in the morning, you'll get a chance soon to see it in the evening.
Because of the viewing geometry, Hale Bopp is visible to the naked eye for a period of about 2 months. It's currently best seen in the morning, but within a few days, it'll start to be a very noticeable evening object. And during the month of April, it'll be very prominent in the evening sky. Moreover, it's unlike the predictions, its brightness is growing instead of leveling off as it approaches its closest point to the sun.
Paul Feldman is a professor of physics and astronomy at Johns Hopkins University. Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today we're talking about green investing. Can you invest your money in ways that help the environment and help you too? We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Our guests today are Elisa Gravitz. She's Executive Director of Co-op America. It's a nonprofit organization that provides economic strategies for businesses and individuals to address today's social and environmental problems. She's in Washington, D.C. Also with us is Dick Pearl. He's senior portfolio manager at the First Manhattan Company in New York, which manages money for individuals, families, pension funds, and eleemosynary institutions. This is a time of year when a lot of folks are making contributions to their individual retirement accounts, or IRAs, and many of them are putting that money into the stock market and mutual funds. One option are the so-called green funds. Elisa, what is a green fund?
A green fund, some people call them socially responsible funds, are basically mutual funds that, in addition to the financial criteria that any mutual fund would have, also are concerned with what kind of investments and what kind of companies. They typically exclude the worst of the polluters. They typically exclude the worst of the companies with bad labor policies. And they typically exclude alcohol, gambling, and tobacco.
Okay. Now, Dick, suppose I'm an environmentalist and I want to invest profitably as I can so I can meet my own needs and maybe have some money left over to give to the National Audubon Society or the Sierra Club and so on.
Yes.
Are there better strategies than investing in these so-called green funds?
Well, if I heard Elisa correctly, she termed the incremental investment in addition to the kinds of investment criteria that other people might use. Now, our investment criteria are that we look for value. We're traditional value investors. And we search for businesses that we think have good franchises and good managements and that sort of thing. And we look for what we can think of as opportunities when market valuations are significantly below business values.
So you think there are better ways to do this than simply opt into the green fund option, which some of the mutual funds are giving you?
Well, Peter, what I was going to say is, as an opinion, I don't think there's any wrong style of investing. But when it comes down to what we actually end up owning, I think we end up owning, given our style of investing, many of the same businesses that people who think of themselves as green investors would own also.
You just get there in a different way.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Okay, well, I want to go to the phones, and let's start in New York. And we have a call from Barbara. Barbara, you're talking green on the Environment Show.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
If I invest my retirement funds in green stocks, will it hurt me financially?
Good question. Let's have answers from both of you. Elisa, somebody investing their retirement funds in green stocks, does it hurt her or can she come out okay?
It will absolutely not hurt you, provided you do your homework carefully like you would do for any investment and come up with a good investor, good investment manager. Let me give you a couple of quick examples. Apples to apples, which is very important in this field that you make sure that you're comparing the right things, the Domini Social Equity Index outperformed the S&P 500 over the last 6 years since it's been alive. The BSI 400 is the country's largest companies, excluding the worst of the polluters, excluding the alcohol, gambling, and tobacco, and including the kind of value-based companies that Dick was talking about.
Okay, Dick, how do you respond to Barbara's question?
Again, I think there's no wrong style of investing. I think over time, different styles will do better or worse depending on whether the wind is at your front or at your back. I've looked at the Domini Social Equity Fund, and I've looked at some of their individual holdings, and many of their holdings are companies that I own or would own. Again, our screen is to look at this from a financial standpoint. I think, Barbara, that you're looking at a moving target, and that it's very difficult to segment out green investing as a criteria. I prefer to look at the standards of looking for value, and over time, I believe that's a better approach.
Okay, well, thanks for the question. Let me ask you something, Elisa, before we go on, and that has to do with how you really know some company is green. What is the criteria? Does the CEO have to drive a Volkswagen? Does the company have to be free of pollution violations? What makes a green company from your perspective?
Well, there's an emerging body of what's called social and environmental research that tracks, again, not only the financial performance of the company, which is the traditional way and, as Dick mentions, very important. It also looks at the company's social and environmental performance. So, for example, in the environmental arena, it will look as to whether or not it's had violations of federal or state laws. It will look at the kind of products. It will look at the impact on the communities. It will look at whether or not the company has taken a leadership position in certain environmental activities. So all in all, it's an additional piece of information that the investment community that's focused on what's called social and environmental research adds to the investment decision.
Okay, now our phones are jumping off the hook. Let's go to Helen in Tacoma, Washington. Helen, you're talking green on the Environment Show.
Hi.
Hi there.
Well, this is something that most of the boards I've sat on have talked about a lot, and one of the things that I'm curious about if...
Now, Helen, before you go on, you're talking about boards of nonprofit institutions?
Nonprofit organizations,
right.
NGOs, non-governmental groups.
And they want to know whether they should be investing...
Who want to put some money aside for their continued well-being, M&O and so forth. I'm curious if a good, clean, healthy environment is good for the economy, as they like to say, why isn't there more advertising about invest in this or that? For instance, paper company, they don't use chlorine bleaches or whatever. Why aren't we pushing these things so people can put their money where their mouth is?
Okay. Well,
advertising is so much a part of our lives. I mean, you just can't avoid it. But
Dick, what are your thoughts on that?
I never hear that happening.
As someone who is seeing what the companies are putting out as you pick stocks, are you seeing...
Well, I think it's a very difficult question that Helen asked. I think that, you know, in many cases, the criteria that we're talking about are goals rather than achievements that have already been met. And in many cases, it's not clear. I mean, as an example, I'm looking at the IBM annual report, and they talk in glowing terms about how they have contributed over $1.2 billion to the economy over the past X number of years. At the same time, I know that IBM has been a polluter of Lake Champlain and of the Hudson River. And I think that responsible shareholders have urged IBM to take responsible actions, and they have. But it's sort of a push-pull. It's not a quickly answerable question that Helen's asking.
Well, I think, Helen, you're absolutely right. All of us who care about this need to get the word out so that people can do the appropriate research and make the appropriate investment decisions for themselves. I mean, when you think of it, so many people like yourself, Helen, are working really hard in their personal lives. You're even volunteering on boards, and you're trying to help clean up the environment. Yet, no matter what anyone does, the average American has far more money in investments than they're ever able to give to charities. So it's really important that we demand of companies environmental responsibility. And one way to send that message strongly is the kinds of companies we'll invest in and the kinds of companies we won't.
Well, Helen, thanks for your question, and let's go into
Peter,
the... Yes.
Can I ask Elisa a question?
Sure.
Would you rather be an owner of a company that you feel is environmentally insufficient and exert that influence as a shareholder, or would you rather not be a shareholder, exclude yourself from that dialogue?
There's a tough one.
I think that's a very good question, and for your listeners, really important in terms of the different kinds of strategies of social investing. One of them is excluding companies from your portfolio that you think are so egregious that you couldn't even sleep well at night if you were making money from them.
Yep.
And that's very important because it sends a signal to companies. It raises the bar for corporate responsibility.
Have you got one of those on the top of your list, Elisa, just quick?
Well, I think a lot of people, for example, right after the Bhopal incident or right after the Exxon Valdez incident, for example, said, no more Exxon. I mean, here's an oil company. Oil is a difficult business, but here's a company that
right.
appears.
And Bhopal was Union Carbide.
That's right.
Yes.
So those are two examples of companies that many people will just say, I can't sleep at night.
Okay.
Now, on the other hand, what Dick is bringing up is something that's very important, a very important social investment strategy, which is for the companies that might do some good things and some bad things. You know, it might be a mixed bag. For you as a responsible shareholder to say, management, I'm an owner. This is what I expect of you. I expect you to clean up this act. I expect you to follow these laws. I expect you not to lobby against things that will matter for our future environment.
Okay, well, let's go back to
That's
the phones
great,
once again. Let's go into the center of the country and hear from Pat in Iowa. Pat, welcome to the Environment Show. You're talking green.
Thank you very much for having me. I would like to go a little bit further on a comment that just was made. As a shareholder, how am I going to be able to select green funds when companies today are so diverse? They may be into oil and food or tobacco and food, many things that, you know, they'll have a combination of good and they'll have a combination of bad. And at the same time, you find companies may be doing a very great environmentally sound business in one part of the country or one town and not so good in another. So how do we filter these things out as sound investors?
Well, I think there's a couple of different strategies. One is there are about 45 mutual funds that are considered socially responsible mutual funds, in that right in their prospectus, they'll tell you what their financial criteria are and what their environmental criteria are. And like any mutual fund, they will list what their investments are. So you can look at those and say, hey, that matches my concerns. I know that the researchers here have the same concerns that I do, and that they're going to make the investments because they have these policies. And that's important, because Dick mentioned earlier that many investors will often end up investing in the same companies as social investors because of the value of the company.
Dick, Pat raises the question of the conglomerate that may do a lot of things. They may make food, they may make cigarettes, they may make airplane parts. One of the things I heard Pat saying is, how do you sort this thing out? How does one ever know whether anybody is green or purple or... who knows what?
Well, I think Elisa gave a very good answer a few moments ago to my question and to Helen's question also. That is that there are some egregious offenders, and she used the Exxon and the Union Carbide example. But more often than not, companies fall in that mid area where it's up to shareholders to look at their annual reports, to look at their proxies, and to vote and to write to the managements of companies that they own or that the mutual funds they own for them. And there are lots of examples of companies that are mixed bags, and which I think, I mean, I'll use as one example, Canadian Pacific, which has had charitable contributions going back to 1921 and gives away 1% of its pre-tax profits each year. But at the same time, Canadian Pacific owns Pan-Canadian Petroleum, which is in the conventional crude and natural gas business, and they own a business called Fording, which mines metallurgical coal. So I think the question is right on. It's not a simple question to answer. I think that this is an evolving subject. I think we're talking a lot about goals rather than actual achievements, and it's up to shareholders to move companies in that direction.
Mm-hmm. But back to Pat and the ways to weave through this. One is to own a mutual fund that does the research on these criteria for you. The second is to go to a socially responsible financial planner or money manager who, again, will help you do the research. The third is to consider a small portion of your portfolio, you know, that portion which is appropriate for you to take some risks in, and really invest in the small, advanced, cutting-edge types of companies that are making a really clear contribution. They may be manufacturing recycling technology, or they may be manufacturing cleanup technology. Those kinds of businesses where you can take the risk to invest in a smaller company, that's the third part of the strategy. So mutual funds, financial advisors who can do the research for you, and then going after those cutting-edge companies for a portion of your portfolio.
Pat, thanks for your question. Great question. And our time is running short. But let me ask you both something, and I'm sure that neither one of you want to answer this. We have had a huge run-up on the stock market. It seems to me that investing green or purple or otherwise, with reasonably good luck, one was making a lot of money in the last couple of years. If one is a green investor, do you need to be more concerned about the fact that this thing may go in the other direction? Are the so-called green funds more likely to drop more quickly? Or is this crystal ball gazing that nobody's going to be able to figure out? Just a few seconds. Dick, how do you come out on that one?
Well, Peter, A, I don't consider myself a green investor. I consider myself a value investor. And I think in investing for value, the issue is finding a value and then determining what you're willing to pay for it. And any time you overpay, as Mr. Buffett said yesterday in his remarks, you run the risk of being ahead of the market and sustaining losses.
Great.
Shorting
in the time remaining, green funds, are they going to drop faster than others?
None of us have a crystal ball, and the past doesn't determine the future. But the last time in the early 90s when we had the drop, the green funds dropped less far. They
I'm afraid our time is up. We'll have to refer you all to the Green Crystal Ball. We've been talking about green investing. And my guests have been Elisa Gravitz from Co-op America and Dick Pearl from the First Manhattan Company. Let's hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. We close with a piece by singer-songwriter Alice DiMicelli from her album, Searching. She urges us to defend the Earth and admonishes that committing global suicide is a bad idea.
When will we understand? No one will have a job if we destroy this land. No, 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 no. Alive and what should not. Someone plays with fire, but you know we're only building our own funeral pyre. How can we sit here intellectualizing when we know what's happening is wrong, causing mass extinction while doctors use machines on human lives to prolong? If someone's playing God, deciding who should be alive and who should not. If someone plays with fire, but you know he's only building his own funeral pyre. Mind, I cannot see the sense of global suicide for the few who live in luxury. Perhaps it's up to you and I to save this world. We'll have to put up one hell of a good fight. A good fight. And we have a voice, and bodies that are strong as the mountain. Yes, we have a choice, be part of the destruction or do something to defend the Earth. Defend the Earth, do what you can, do what you must, but just do something to defend the Earth. Defend the Earth, do what you can, do what you must, but just do something to defend the Earth. Defend the Earth, do what you can, do what you must, but just do something to defend the Earth. Defend the Earth, do what you can, do what you must, but just do something to defend the Earth. Defend the Earth.
That was Alice DiMicelli singing Defend the Earth from her album, Searching. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 377. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.